Scott, the network. There's a lot of talk about the value of networks to young professionals and grad students, specifically in the business world. But of course, the value of professional networks is not limited just to the business world. Today, we're going to explore that concept with a physician in training, Kemi Tomobi. She is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the Student National Medical Association. Before Kemi and I start our conversation, I also want to introduce you to a couple of resources that will help you with your MCAS applications and secondary applications if you are currently applying to medical school. First, we have ACE the MCAS, a free downloadable special report, and the link to it is in our show notes at info.xzipit.com/24, just the number 24. And then there's also Secondary Essays 101, which is a collection of tips, articles, and more that are online and will help you make the most of your secondary applications. And again, that too is, you can find, link to it you can find at our show notes, info.xzipit.com/24. Without further ado, I'm excited to welcome Kemi Tomobi. We've met virtually online in the last several weeks, but this is the first time I've actually had the chance to speak with Kemi, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. Thanks for joining me, Kemi, on Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got interested in becoming a physician?
Definitely. I was born in Louisiana, grew up in Maryland. My parents are Nigerian, so they came here to study, to go to school and stuff, and I was born in the process of that, and three of my brothers came afterwards. So I'm the oldest of four of us, and I'm the only girl. And my interest in medicine started with a family illness. I have a brother who has sickle cell anemia, sickle cell disease. I don't know how many people are familiar with that, but it's a genetic disease that's very common in the African-American population that wasn't where it affects your blood circulation and that the blood cells aren't formed properly. Right. They're formed properly at first, but then later on they take on a sickle shape. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that tool that farmers use. It looks like a sickle.
Yes.
Almost like a moon, kind of. And those cells aren't as functional as regular round donut-shaped red blood cells are. So as a result of that, they tend to clump up and they tend to clog blood clots anywhere in the body. It could be in the stomach, could be in the brain, could be in the lungs. And so that's where sickle cell disease becomes very problematic, is that it can affect any area of the body, and these patients start complaining of lots of pain and start losing oxygen to certain areas of their body. In addition to that, they come with this pain crisis that usually lands them in the hospital. And when my brother was born, as with most sickle cell disease, people with sickle cell disease are born, they're normal at birth, but it's not until 6 months or later that they start having those symptoms. And that was the case with my brother, because at the time he was born, I don't believe they had the universal screening for sickle cell that they do today. You know, all newborns are screened for sickle cell at birth, but he was not. And so it wasn't until 6 months of age and later that my parents and I and the rest of us started wondering what was going on with him, because he was just so normal, and he just started rapidly getting worse. And then he was in the hospital a lot. I took care of him at some of those times in the hospital. Sometimes I would accompany him to the hospital. You know, I wasn't really old enough to know a lot of what was going on. But with time, I started becoming interested in pediatric things, things that happen with kids and having compassion for them. And I became interested in working with kids. So that's where that interest developed. And then when I went on to college and studied a lot of the sciences and did some community service, I further developed my interest and said I knew I wanted to go to the medical school and become a physician. I was initially interested in working with kids, but realized, you know, you don't have to be a pediatrician to work with kids. There's so many avenues. That's one of the great things about medicine, is that, you know, you can choose what population you want to work for. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, if you want to work with women, it doesn't have to be like OB-GYN. You can be like a surgeon who does, you know, woman cases of the heart or something. So that's one of the great things about medicine. So I was more interested in the operating room. I found that pace much better, much quicker. Not any quicker, but it was just different than being on the floors and dealing with primary care issues. And it's not that I don't like primary care. I think it's a very important part of medicine, but I just felt like my mind worked specifically towards like specializing in one area and dealing with one thing. And the thing was, and so I thought between surgery and anesthesia, what I liked about anesthesia was that you're focusing on one patient at a time.
Right.
And that's something that I like, because I'm a person who likes to do one-on-one in a lot of my interactions. And so I thought anesthesia fit me well for that. And then also because in college I majored in neuroscience, and I liked that, those things, chemistry, neuroscience and all. And I thought, hey, this is a field that where I can apply those things in medicine. So that's how I, that's a little bit about myself.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I know, again, we met online. I think you were writing in your capacity as editor-in-chief of the Journal of the Student National Medical Association. Can you tell us a little bit about the Student National Medical Association, and then how did you become the editor-in-chief of that publication?
Sure. The Student National Medical Association, also known as SNMA, was created about 50 years ago with a mission of serving underserved communities, including minorities, communities of color, and other disadvantaged communities, and particularly minority students of color, and those interested in the issues of minority students of color. So you didn't have to be a minority to be a part of SNMA, and just had to be interested in the issues that SNMA embodies. And that includes, you know, issues of health disparities, issues that affect minority students at the undergraduate and medical school level. And that's something that SNMA has been doing pretty strongly for the past almost 50 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're celebrating their 50th anniversary next year.
Wow.
So that's something that's really big, that's going to be worth celebrating and gearing up for that, because the national conference is going to be in D.C. Next spring, so that's supposed to be a huge thing. And SNMA is usually medical students, but there's also an undergraduate chapter called MAP, Minority Association of Pre-Health Students. That hasn't been around as long, maybe 25 years, but it's supposed to be like an umbrella branch of SNMA. So they serve both undergraduate and college students. Undergraduate and medical students, and in addition to that, they have some community service programs that cater to grade school students. I guess introducing science or tutoring or other like other services to grade school students as well. So it's definitely growing. It's almost 50 years, and it's really a big accomplishment that it's been around and it's serving all these people. So
that's great.
And I became editor-in-chief. It's really interesting. When I first started school, I was interested in doing publications. I wasn't sure how to go about doing that. So my involvement in SNMA was pretty little. At the chapter level, you know, I went to all the SNMA events. I mentored an undergraduate. But it wasn't until the national committees were forming, and they wanted all the members to keep updating their databases, and their recruiting people to write for the publications committee. And then I got interested in that, and I thought, oh, well, because the elections that was going on, there was this issue on Affordable Care Act. And so they thought, okay, let's write something about it, but let's wait until after the election first. We don't want to do it.
this was the 2012 elections, right?
Before the election, because we want to see who's going to be in office. We can start writing about the Affordable Care Act. So I said, okay, I'll write about how it affects underserved populations, meaning not just underrepresented minorities, but also women and other people who could be affected. So that's how I wrote about it. And then because I maintained my involvement in the journal, I was nominated to be one of the chairs, the publication co-chairs. Mm-hmm. And so that position started in April. And one of the co-chairs has the responsibility of taking care of the journal, and the other co-chair has responsibility of taking care of all the other publication stuff, which is like a lot of the pre-medical stuff that gets sent out to medical students, a lot of stuff on the JSNMA website. Those are the things that the other publication chair takes care of. And I said, okay, I'll take on this role. I'm happy about it. So I thought, well, maybe a few years ago, this is something that I wanted to do. And now I'm getting a chance to do it. So I'm happy about it. So that's how I got to be editor-in-chief. It's kind of like a zigzag road, but it's that's where I am right now.
All right.
I enjoy it.
And so obviously how long have you been involved with the SNMA? Total.
SNMA, wow, years. I don't know if I count undergraduate years, I'd say I'd say more than 6 years.
Okay.
I count my undergraduate, and yeah, I'd say more than six, seven.
And where did you go to college undergraduate?
Oh, I forgot I mentioned that part. Johns Hopkins.
Johns Hopkins,
Johns
okay.
Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah, fantastic. I've heard of it. and what about, so one of the things that, you know, sometimes I hear bandied around, and I think it's true, but I also think it deserves some greater exploration, is the value of getting involved in clubs on as an undergraduate and also in graduate school, the importance of developing a network. I'm just curious, how obviously your involvement has benefited the organization. They have somebody running their publication. And the people who read the publication benefit from the publication, or they wouldn't be reading it. But how have you, as a medical student and as a future physician, benefit, or even as an undergraduate student, benefited from your participation in NMSA?
Okay, great. I'll start with undergrad and then I'll add the med school part of it. In undergraduate, you know, you're living away, if I lived away from home, even though I was in state, and I definitely wanted to make friends and meet people. And at the same time, I wanted to devote myself to something to show that I was able to rise to a leadership role, because that's important. I mean, you don't have to be president or, you know, all of that in the organization, but it does help to show if you've been in an organization for at least a year or two, it shows that you have some type of commitment to something, and you're not like, what's the word I'm looking for, flaky, and being
you take responsibility. Yeah, you take responsibility.
Yeah, exactly, and that's something that's important, and particularly with something like with service, community service, type of dedication to a population or to a cause. If you have that going on for an extended period of time, that, I mean, obviously you shouldn't do it just to look good on your application, but you should do it to show that you have a passion for something, and it should be something you like. And that's something that's going to reflect well, not only on your applications to graduate school or medical school, but also it reflects well on, you know, how you connect with people, you know, networking, you know, maintaining those long-term friendships, and so on. So I found that helpful for me in college. I didn't do too many. I tried to say 3 was the max I was going to do in terms of activities. I did ministry. I did 2 ministries because I was exploring that in college. I sang in the choir, and I did some campus ministry stuff. And I also served as a mentor to college freshmen. So I did that junior and senior year of college. And I found all of them enjoyable. I thought I grew a lot of it because of it. I also gained opportunities to be a mentor and to teach things that I loved to do and that showed through. In addition to that, I thought to get some patient exposure. Right? I needed money when I was in college, no doubt. So I also had a part-time job, and I worked at the hospital, the Hopkins Hospital, part-time in the Wilmer Eye Institute, which is a place for people to see their eye patients. So that's I helped doctors with that aspect of their patient care. So that was my my way of making money at the same time. So,
sure.
So that was very good in terms of networking, getting letters of recommendations from organizations, and just to have balance. I mean, you can't do, I mean, because I knew I couldn't do school the whole time. And I feel like I'm a person that likes to be, I know it's good to relax, but I know I'm a person who likes to be busy. Not a very busy, but scheduled. So, like, if I didn't have all those extracurriculars, I probably wouldn't devote as much time as I did to my studies. You know, I wouldn't take that chemistry exam as seriously if I didn't have, if I didn't do 2 hours of singing the day before, I probably would not have as much urgency to study the next day or something like that. So that's part of me, my being busy. So those are the ways that it's helped me. It's helped me to prioritize things in terms of my scheduling. It also helped me in terms of networking, and also helped me in terms of, you know, the next step, in terms of letters of recommendations and, you know, getting my application ready for medical school.
Right. And I assume
that's at the college level.
Right. And okay, so go ahead. Could you then explore at the medical school level?
Medical school, I'll be honest, it's harder to, I don't know anyone who's in 3 extracurriculars, maybe 1 or 2. Because at medical school, most people, there are some people who've had started families and been married, or it's different than college. And it's a higher percentage of people who are untraditional, at least at Rochester, more untraditional applicants there. Some of them were like much older, in their mid to late 30s, starting out, maybe from a different career, or they've had a recent interest in medicine, or for whatever reason, they're starting at that age and they have families and stuff. So I think it's a different field than college, where everyone's trying to rush into the dorms and be independent and, you know, live that college life. I think in medical schools, at least my experience is a little different. So the extracurricular part of it isn't as much of a priority. If you're going to be in one, and I didn't do as many, obviously, particularly as you get towards the clinical years, you're not going to be doing any extracurricular, just because, you know, your schedule is not, you don't have as much control over that. But SMMA was one I did, and the other one I did was admissions. So I would recruit people for, I would do the tour guides for medical school. Uh-huh. So anytime they're on interview day for medical school, there'd be maybe 10 to 15 people interviewing that day. And during the lunch hour, myself and another student would have lunch with them and have them ask us any questions during the lunch hour, and then we'd give them a tour of the medical campus. So that was my main thing that I did, the admissions and also the SMMA as well. And then Toastmasters. Toastmasters not as much. But SMMA and certainly the admissions counseling I did. And I also loved it when I interviewed students for prospective students for medical school. So I also loved doing that.
Great.
On the admissions committee. So
great, yes. Great. Now, do you also belong to AMSA, the American Medical Students Association? Or did you ever belong to it?
Yes. I didn't do as much at the chapter. At the chapter level, I haven't done as much with AMSA, but I have done some of their national stuff. The one I did was, I don't know if you're familiar with the Women's Empowerment Institute. It's one that I went to. I drove all the way from Rochester to Virginia. I think it's a little held in Virginia. And it was a bunch of us girls getting together to discuss issues of how women can assert themselves more in the workplace, in the classroom, and so on. And we did a lot of activities together to get us, you know, talking about what projects we're going to do to encourage more women awareness. And what we also did, we went to Capitol Hill and we advocated for against a law that would allow women to be sold.
Oh my goodness!
Slavery in another country. So that was a fun. I mean, the law is not fun, but it was a great experience to talk with our legislators.
I can imagine
at Capitol Hill. Against that, so that was a great experience and great people, great group of people, great talented group of people, and it showed me a great deal what AMSA was about. So I was really happy and fortunate to be able to go to that opportunity, and would look forward to doing more. So
right, I noticed that you're also very involved in tutoring. How do you find time for all this stuff? I mean, medical school is grueling.
Right. Some stuff is fall, and some stuff is spring, and some of it is for credit, so it's not like you get paid for it all the time. In the anatomy lab, you don't really get paid for it as much because it's considered an elective.
Right.
So that's one thing. In college, I got paid for it. I did chemistry, and only did it when chemistry was offered, so that didn't take too much of my time.
Right.
In college, but it also helped me, you know, in terms of keeping my chemistry knowledge current, and when I was studying for MCATs, it helped that I didn't have to review as much for
it.
So
right.
I didn't feel like that was time lost. In medical school, similar thing in terms of like tutoring in like anatomy and physiology. I feel like I'm not tutoring in something that's useless. I feel like it still be useful later on. So I don't feel like it's time gone or time lost. And also, some people do it for pay. Some people do it for an elective as part of the curriculum and stuff, so it works both ways. So in terms of time loss, it's not as big of a deal. I don't know anyone who tutors like 40 hours a week. I think the most anyone would tutor is maybe 20 hours at the max.
That's a lot.
On a light, for pay, 20 hours max for on a light semester.
That would be a lot.
If the semester is really heavy, I don't see anyone tutoring more than 5 hours a week.
Right. How did I know? I know you're. I know you're taking a bit of a break from your medical studies, but how did you enjoy your studies at the University of Rochester?
Academically, I loved it. I felt very prepared academically for it. I was happy to have met a whole nice group of people from all different walks of the country, and maybe a few from all over the world. A few people, you know, who were from out of country attending medical school. So I thought it was a great mix. I liked his emphasis on community service. I think that was one of the themes that attracted me to Rochester, and I also liked his, how it dealt with neuroscience. I think it was taught very well at the medical school level. I thought the department was good in that. I enjoyed going to Ecuador. That was something that University of Rochester does well. So,
how long were you in Ecuador, and what was the program or whatever that you were on?
Right, it was 6 weeks, so we had to be there for at least 6 weeks, and we were paid for it. But we did research on how people there used water and what were their beliefs about water and their health. So we had to learn out some Spanish, obviously, before going. But no amount of Spanish really helped us until we actually got there and really started speaking Spanish, you know, being in the field and actually speaking Spanish for real.
So
that was a great experience. We interviewed them in Spanish. We had an interpreter between Spanish and the native language that was not Spanish or English. So that was a really, really great experience. We got to shadow people and work with people in the hospitals as well. And then the last few weeks, we just traveled, you know, Galapagos Islands. We saw pretty much a lot of places all over the country before coming back to the States. So it was a really great experience for me and for the other people that went along with me. There were several other medical students from all over the country that were there, and two were also from the University of Rochester. So I thought it was a really great experience.
That's great.
And it's something that University of Rochester does a lot of, the international travel. I think after the first year of med school, I think at least a third to half of students go abroad and do some type of project every summer.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so that was one of my highlights. And I also did a community service thing in New Orleans. So that was really, really good.
After the hurricane?
Yes, after like a few years after the hurricane. Yep. So that was good.
How do you see your medical career progressing?
It's a good question. I thought academic medicine. I thought physician journalist. I thought physician this, physician that. I always feel like I'm going to combine my career and passions in caregiving with something. And I've always liked academic medicine. So introducing the teaching and mentoring component along with some form of research and along with the caregiving, I thought that my career would take some shape in some form of those three as my career progressed. I would like to develop some type of research interest in residency that will carry me through beyond residency. And as I said earlier, I am interested in anesthesia, and particularly academic anesthesia, and with the possibility of doing a peds fellowship, because I do want to work with children and work with children in the OR particularly, and I think pediatric anesthesia would be a great fit for me. So,
my daughter is a child life specialist. She's not a physician at all. It's only, you know, no science, but she is. She works daily with children in a hospital setting. She actually works at a children's
hospital.
She did
what?
She works daily with children in hospital settings.
Oh, yes.
But you know, not as a physician, not in any kind of like, she doesn't wear a white coat. That's part of what she does. She's like the kid's friend and advocate and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
no uniform. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. That definitely reduces that that anxiety and barrier. You know, take off the white coat.
Yeah.
So yeah.
She plays with them when they're not screaming bloody murder.
What age group does she usually work with?
She works with, I mean, not usually babies, but anywhere from toddler up to teens. It's really anybody, any children who are usually lengthily hospitalized. And she will attempt to explain procedures on their level, provide appropriate play activities. She runs a playroom. If a child is having a meltdown, she's the one that's usually called by the medical staff. She's not technically, she's not a nurse or a doctor or any of those things. She loves her work, but it's not easy work.
Right. Yeah, care of kids is not easy.
No, not especially not sick children. Now, one of the things I've been noticing as we've been talking is, you talked about your initial interest in medicine coming from your brother's unfortunate experience. So that would be hematology. You've talked about an interest in anesthesiology. You've talked about pediatrics. You've talked about neuroscience. I think that was your undergraduate major, right?
Yes.
Right. So you seem to have a lot. You've talked about how you love teaching, the importance of communications, and I assume if you're editor-in-chief, you must like writing. You seem to have a lot of different interests.
Mm-hmm.
Are you having trouble narrowing them down?
Narrowing? Oh, well, not sort of.
It's a good problem to have, by the way.
That's a good question.
It's a good problem to have. It's much better, I think, to be attracted to many different things and find everything boring and uninteresting. So it's a good problem.
Right. I know I'm not interested in hematology. I found it depressing. Not necessarily depressing, especially adult hematology. I found it very, I found it sad.
It is sad.
I'm not saying that my brother's situation is necessarily sad. I do hope it has a happy ending. But working with patients, other people who have similar or battling similar issues, particularly in cancer, I found it very sad. And so I do have a passion for caring for them, but I don't think it's something I'd want to do long term.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so that's how it was very easy for me to rule out hematology and oncology from that experience. I knew for sure the OR is where I wanted to be. I knew for sure. I knew I couldn't do the, not that I couldn't, but I wasn't interested in being on the floors. I was not interested so much in clinic, not so much interested in the emergency room, although I thought I'd be interested in emergency medicine, but I wasn't. So I thought, My narrowed it down pretty quickly to surgery or anesthesia after my clinical exposures to those two. And I'm leaning more anesthesia because of the subject matter. I really like it, the anesthesia. And then lifestyle, kind of.
Yeah, sure.
I know anesthesiologists do work hard, so it's not like they're working 30 hours a week or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love the patient. I like that the patient interaction is just so deep and intense in anesthesia. Like,
okay.
Patient has to basically trust you to do something really deep and really big, and working on that level of trust is something that I really like doing. I like the level of patient care that I have to provide. It's very intense, and I really like that in anesthesia.
Good. And also, I guess, wouldn't it in some way also relate to your initial interest in neuroscience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like neuroscience, that's I thought neurology would have been something I would have liked, but when it didn't. I felt like the application of neuroscience wasn't something I saw in neurology. It felt like it was like strokes and seizures and stuff. You're dealing with stuff after it's happened, and stuff. And versus something like anesthesia, you're taking care of it as it happens, and you're getting the results of it right away.
Okay.
I guess they call that instant gratification. So which is something they say, oh, if you want to be a doctor, they'll pick up instant gratification. But there are some specialties where there's more instant gratification than others.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. So. For sure. For sure. Now, you obviously have your own experience as a medical school applicant, but you also have experience, working with medical pre-meds coming into medical school, and you have experience working with medical school admissions at the University of Rochester. Do you have any tips for pre-med applicants now working either on the MCAS application or on secondary applications?
Yes. Make sure you get those letters of recs in as soon. Not get letters of recs, but choose your letters of rec writers very carefully. It's really important.
And what do you recommend? What criteria do you recommend?
I'd say if you're a science major, I would think that two of your recommendations should come from science courses, whether they're in your major or not. Some like two science classes. And one that's like well-rounded, maybe like a community recommendation or someone who's like observed you either clinically or observed you doing community service or some type of extracurricular activity, that would help.
Mm-hmm.
If you've done research may help if you've published, and if you've like someone if you've had some type of research mentor over the long term, that's particularly helpful for people who've been out of college and are doing research before applying to medical school. Usually, they get a letter of recommendation from their research mentor.
Right.
Right. What else in terms of MCAS? The essay is really important. That may be the deciding factor as to whether you get a secondary or not.
Mm-hmm.
So to make sure that you get proofread, maybe get like three or four people to proofread your application, someone who's knowledgeable about medicine, someone who has a really, really, really astute command of communications in the English language, and then maybe someone who knows you like personally, like a friend. So right. If you have one of each of those, you'll get a well-rounded representation of feedback on the essay. So you don't want any errors when you submit your MCAT. So that may be a turning point as to whether you get a secondary. It's like, okay, is this person very detail-oriented? Did this person catch this error, this typo on their application? So that's something that's really important. And then in terms of the content, you definitely want to grab their attention in the first paragraph if possible. I remember in my essay, I wrote something about playing the piano or something.
Mm-hmm.
I remember even my college application, I think in one of them, I kind of like wrote something about how, so I did ROTC before, and I was talking about how exercise, you know, and how like being very loyal and building teamwork was something that I was striving towards. So I started out with something that was very startling, like an opening sentence that would make them think, oh my gosh, I want to read what this person's going to say.
That's a good goal.
That's definitely important for AMCAS. And then secondaries are specific to the school.
Right.
So let's say you get a secondary from the University of Rochester. You don't want to answer it the same way you'd answer like a letter, like a secondary from, Hopkins or something, because each school is different. They ask specific set of questions that are specific to their school. You want to make sure you do the background research on that school before you answer the questions appropriately. If University of Rochester doesn't have a psychiatry department, and you say you want to be a psychiatrist, that means you haven't really researched the school enough to know what they have to offer. So that's really important when you're answering your secondaries. Obviously, Rochester does have a psych, but I was just using that as an example. So that's really important. I'm trying to think, what else? Those are secondaries, and then study with interviews. If you get the interviews, like follow up with that. Always definitely do even more research on the school. So that's my two cents so far.
You should know that I'm this morning, just before the call, I was preparing for a webinar I'm giving on Wednesday, which I think I've already aired by the time this segment airs, but the video will be available if anybody's interested. And I was I'm exactly making the points that you just made. In terms of the secondaries, the webinar is called Secondaries with Sizzle, that you have to show fit. You have to do your research in order to be able to show that fit. So I couldn't agree with you more in terms of your tips for applicants. Now, I think our podcast is just about over. Kemi, where can interested listeners learn more about the Student National Medical Association and the Journal of the Student National Medical Association?
Good questions. The Student National Medical Association is found on www.snma.org. Okay. www.snma.org.
All right.
And the Journal of the Student National Medical Association, Student National Medical Association, is www.jsnma.org.
All right, and we'll include links in the show notes to both those websites. Now, listener, thank you too for joining us. Again, there are several great resources linked to in today's show notes, both the resources that Kemi just mentioned as well as the ones that I mentioned earlier in the show. Finally, please share your feedback. 5-star reviews on iTunes are particularly welcome, and you can always leave any kind of feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing linda@accepted.com. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by accepted.com, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.